Hi, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and welcome to What Women Must Know. Thank you for joining me today for another opportunity to have an in-depth conversation about a topic that can really change your life. And as always, this show is dedicated to empowering you with truthful information so you can really make the best choices possible regarding your health and well-being. And if you're visiting for the first time, I'd like to welcome you and to invite you to go to my website, which is whatwomenmustknow.com. And, I send these shows out on a regular basis, so you never miss an episode. And also, I have special reports available, so when you opt in there, you'll get a lot of great information. And also, hop over to my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know. Like me over there because I post on a daily basis really great information and articles and latest research and some good recipes and just some fun things to keep you learning about the truth regarding your health and well-being. So hope you'll take advantage of all those opportunities. And today I'm really excited because I have a wonderful guest. He's been on my show many times before. He has a new book out. He is an amazing personality and researcher and inspiration for all of us. So I'd like to introduce you to Dr. Michael Mosley. And we're talking about his latest book, The Clever Gut Diet, How to Revolutionize Your Body from the Inside Out. And if you have not come across Dr. Mosley before, let me tell you a little bit about him. He's trained to be a doctor by the Royal Free Hospital in London. After qualifying, he joined the BBC, where he has become a well-known television presenter. He is the author of The Fast Diet and the 8-Week Blood Sugar Diet. And his most recent book is The Clever Gut Diet, How to Revolutionize Your Body from the Inside Out. And as always, Dr. Michael Mosley has some great information, entertaining information, but most importantly, profound information to help you regain your health and optimize your health. So he's calling all the way over from the UK, and it is such a pleasure to welcome you again to the show, Dr. Michael Mosley.
Hi there. Lovely to be on the show again.
And congratulations on your new book. Well, I read it cover to cover, and I love the message. I've talked many times about the importance of our healthy microbiome and to really support our gut, and we're going to be talking about that topic and the research you've done. But I have to say, Michael, you always amaze me at these interesting things you do to get material for your book. And in your new book, you talked about what you did with a little special camera on television. Can you share the experience and what you learned?
Absolutely. So this was a few years ago, and I was making a television show called Inside Michael Mosley, which was on the BBC and also showed on PBS. And so what we decided would be quite fun was I went down to the Science Museum in London, and I swallowed a pill camera, which is a kind of tiny little camera about the size of a fairly large capsule, and it has a flashing light, and it takes about 20 or 30 pictures a second. And I swallowed that, and it was linked to a monitor, which in turn was linked to a large screen. So there were a few hundred people in the museum who came along to kind of watch what happened next. And before that, I'd swallowed a few pints of laxative the night before, so I'd kind of cleaned out my system. And I swallowed a pill camera, and you could maneuver it around with a magnet, so we could watch what would happen as the pill cam journeyed its way through my body. And it started off, obviously, with my swallowing it, and when it got to my stomach, I also ate a light meal, so you could actually watch the process of digestion beginning in the stomach, and then the pill camera continued on its journey. So that program, the pill camera took about 14 hours to do its full journey, but not many people were still there in the museum at the end. It was kind of novel and surprising, but it was the whole thing was condensed down in the television program to 1 hour, but included an awful lot of information about the gut and what the gut does. And that kind of got me interested. I had, around that time, I also had discovered I was type 2 diabetic, and that led me to invent something called the 5-2 diet, intermittent fasting. And I read a book called The Fast Diet, which was all about how you can kind of reverse type 2 diabetes, but also how you can lose weight on this particular type of diet. And that became a New York Times bestseller and an international bestseller. And again, that was all part of this sort of story, if you like, about the impact that food has on your body and what it can do. Because although I had extensive medical training, when I was at medical school, we learned nothing about diet. And so a lot of what I've learned has been learned since I left medical school. And that's kind of surprising how little doctors know. So doctors know about giving you pills, but they don't know a lot about how to offer useful health advice when it comes to diet, as in to food, the foods you should eat, the foods you should avoid, the best ways of actually kind of losing weight, and the best ways of keeping your gut in good shape.
And when it comes to the gut, I don't think medical training has caught up with the research and the profound significance of a healthy gut and digestive tract and how it's impacting all aspects of our health. So I think that's what we really want to talk about in the time that we have you, because I know you're on this crazy schedule today, speaking all over the country.
Yeah.
But can you just give us, very briefly, first of all, just explain the process of digestion? Because, by the way, is that videotaping of your journey into your digestive tract available on YouTube or on a website somewhere?
I'm sure. I haven't Googled it recently, but I'm sure it's available. I have fans all over the world, and they tend to stick these things up. It's certainly
we'll look for it
on PBS.
Well, we get to know you inside out.
Inside out, more than you could ever want to know. Yeah.
Okay, so why don't we just start just briefly, so people understand what their digestive system is all about. I always want people to really start with some basic information, and then we can go from there and build on it.
Sure. So actually, digestion begins even before you put the food in your mouth. That the sight and the smell of food will actually start triggering responses in your brain and in your gut. So even, for example, whether you feel hungry or not, that is partly the product of the time of day. So it's not that you're suddenly short of food because you're in danger of starvation. It's 1 o'clock in the afternoon. I always eat at 1 o'clock, and your brain starts to think, well, I'll get ready for it. Then you get the sight and the smell, your mouth starts to produce saliva in anticipation of the food that's going to come. Then you kind of eat the food, it passes down, it gets into your stomach. And when it's in your stomach, it hits an acid bath, and the acid is partly there to help digestion, but mainly there to kind of kill the bacteria, any pathogens that may be coming in the food or the drink. And then it goes to the small intestine, which is the next stage. And there, the food is rapidly absorbed, the bits which are easy to break down. So one of the problems with, say, having a diet which is rich in simple carbohydrates like pasta or potatoes or rice or, you know, cookies or things like that, is that the sugars in those foods are very rapidly broken down and digested and absorbed in your small intestine. And that sounds as though it's a good thing, but actually it's a very bad thing, because what happens is it leads to a big surge in your blood sugar levels. So your blood sugars storm up. And so your body really doesn't like having a lot of sugar in the system, because sugar is toxic. It's very bad for your organs. It's bad for lots of things. So your pancreas then pumps out lots of insulin, and that brings your blood sugars down. But if you do that repeatedly throughout the day, then it's a bit like shouting at the kids, that eventually your body becomes insulin resistant. Basically, you pump out more and more insulin, but you're unable to bring your blood sugars down quite as effectively. So typically this happens to people who eat a very sort of, as I said, a carb-rich diet, particularly one which contains kind of lots of fat but lots of readily digestible carbs. And the reasons why you don't want to have lots of insulin running around your system is insulin is a hormone that brings your blood sugars down, but it also switches off fat burning. So you will accumulate fat. And the other thing it does is it leads to proliferation of cells. And so, for example, it increases your risk of breast cancer. High amounts of insulin running around your system is a significant risk factor for breast cancer. So that is the downside of eating lots of sugary, carby things. They get absorbed very rapidly in the small intestine. The rest of the food, things like protein and fat, they also get absorbed, but what is left going on down the system is mainly fiber and also this stuff called resistant starch. So the average American woman eats probably half the amount of fiber she should, maybe a third. And also a very, very narrow range of foods. And this is bad for your gut, because, or at least for your gut bacteria, because the ones down there, the microbiome, they depend. They are sitting there at the bottom of your intestine, and they depend on the food which is going to reach them from higher up. And so if you're, you know, eating fiber-rich foods, then they get lots of this lovely fiber, which they then create chemicals from, like butyrate, which are really good for your gut, but which also are good for your brain. But if you eat a lot of kind of fast food, junk food, and things like that, then instead what your gut is exposed to are these substances called emulsifiers. And what they do is they tend to knock off the good bacteria. So broadly speaking, that's the process. You eat the foods. Most of the nutrients are removed in the small intestine. The kind of fiber and some of the other things make its way down to the large intestine. Frankly, the quality of the food you've eaten in the first place is going to hugely influence the mix of microbes in your gut. Other things which influence them include exercise, stress, sleep, and things like that.
So when we talk about the microbiome, this community, the rainforest of all these diverse species, thousands of them, of these microbiota that exist, they exist in our large intestine, not in the small intestine. So it's our large intestine where these amazing beings actually go to work. So can we talk about some of the critical things that happen when we have a healthy community of microbiota in our large intestine?
Sure. So what you have down there is a whole, it's probably 1,000 different species. But amongst them, there are a particular group which are known as the old friends. Scientists call them the old friends because we evolved with them, and they are essential for our health. They are essential for our mental health. They are also responsible for educating and training our immune system. So you're probably familiar with the fact that over the last, you know, 50 or 60 years, there's been an incredible growth in allergies, in things like asthma, eczema, food allergies, gut intolerances, and things like that. Now, these are a response to a hyper-responsive immune system, and an immune system which is a bit out of control and has started to attack bits of the body. And the reason that the immune system is out of control is it wasn't educated in the first place what to attack and what not to attack. And that's partly down to the fact that these old friends, these good bacteria, may not have been kind of there present to do the kind of training. It's a bit like kind of grandma bringing up the kids and teaching them how to behave. Now, the reason this is so critically important is because the balance is so important in the immune system. To kind of go back to where your good bacteria, your old friends come from, you actually inherit them from your mum. So when you're in your mother's tummy, when you're in the womb, your gut is almost entirely sterile. And then if you are born vaginally, what happens is you actually, you know, get samples of her feces. Sorry if that sounds terrible, but essentially as you come down the birth canal, you swallow stuff, and that populates your gut, and that actually influences what your microbiome will look like over the next, you know, 10, 20, 30, 40 years. So there's a big difference between kids who are born by cesarean section and those who are born naturally, and this effect persists into adulthood. The other thing that's really important is breastfeeding. And within the breast milk, there is a substance which puzzled scientists for a long time, because nobody really understood why it was there. It's what's called a galacto-oligofructosaccharide. It's a particular type of sugar. But it's not a substance that babies can absorb. So why on earth is a mother's milk producing something which the baby cannot digest? And that was a real puzzle for a long time. And then more recently they discovered that what it's really doing is it's feeding a particular type of bacteria, which is called Bifidobacteria infantilis. And if you get breast milk with this stuff in it, then this particular type of bacteria will proliferate. And it turns out this particular bacteria is very beneficial to the baby. So it shows you what a close contact there is between these old friends, if you like, and us, that we have evolved so that a mother produces milk with a substance in it whose only function is to feed these bacteria. And if you don't feed them, then they tend to kind of fade away, and that puts you at greater risk of allergy later in life. So we know that kids, for example, who are breastfed are less likely to become overweight and are also less likely to develop allergies than those who are not breastfed. And indeed those who are born by cesarean section, or indeed those who are exposed to antibiotics at a young age. All these things tend to produce a less healthy microbiome.
You know, I just want to jump in around this issue because it is now recognized that children who are born cesarean birth don't get seeded properly with the proper microbiota that is found in the vaginal tract and the rest of the process. They're kind of brought out and they take their first breath in an operating theater and breathe in type of bacteria that really should never be there. And these kids tend to have more skin problems, more allergies, you were saying, just they're not digesting properly. And they're developing this new procedure now, which I'm really thrilled to see it happening in hospitals, which is the seeding process. They go back in and then take a swab from the mother's vaginal tract and put it all over the baby's body and face so it can, in a sense, artificially get seeded with what didn't happen during the birth process but is now happening right after. And you write about that in your book as well.
I do, because I think that's a really interesting area of research. And what they're doing now is looking at whether that has a long-term impact. So it's going to be a while before we know if that is an effective way of helping people who've had to have a cesarean section. Obviously, I would hope that some cesarean sections are absolutely necessary, but rates are unbelievably high in places like the US and the UK, and probably far more so than, frankly, is desirable. And there are lots of reasons why that happens. But I think this research is really useful. There is a potential downside, which I also write about, which is if it's done properly, if it's, you know, done in a proper center and it's, you know, people are careful about it, then that's good. The danger is that people are kind of doing it almost freelance, and you've got to be careful because, you know, if the mother has some form of vaginal infection, which is certainly possible, then, you know, seeding the baby or giving the baby a swab is going to be very bad for the baby. And so that's just kind of a note of caution when it comes to kind of doing this stuff. It's absolutely fascinating, but equally one has to be a little bit careful about it, a bit cautious.
Yes, and absolutely true. And but it just brings home the point that cesarean births, which are done as you were saying, there are high rates in the UK, Australia, and the US, have serious consequences, and it should really be given serious thought and only used as a procedure when absolutely necessary, not at the convenience of the doctor or the parents.
Absolutely.
So let's talk about some other things you have written about and the research you've been doing about the importance of a healthy gut. Let's talk about the things that, first of all, further challenge and compromise our healthy microbiome, and then the strategies to actually rebuild a healthy environment and a healthy microbiome.
Okay. Where do you want to start?
Let's start with some of the things that actually are impairing the healthy rainforest, the healthy species, the 1,000 or so species that are necessary to support our health. Let's talk about what's really challenging it and some of the impacts of those things towards our immune system and our moods, and then the solutions.
Sure. So as we've already talked about, there is a significant downside to being born by cesarean section, which obviously you have no choice over, and quite often the mother has no choice over. So, that is something which is likely to lead to an abnormal gut biome. Breastfeeding we talked about. Beyond that, one of the problems is the overuse of antibiotics. So antibiotics, absolutely life-saving. The first proper antibiotics introduced in 1945, that was penicillin. Many mothers, women, child, men. My life was probably saved when I was a child by penicillin, because I was born in India. Apparently I got a really bad infection and the antibiotics kind of sorted it out. So without doubt, antibiotics, great, but they have been hugely abused and overused, and that is creating a big problem. It's not just the antibiotics in humans, but also in animals, in cattle and things like that. So I was recently down in Texas, and I was filming in a cattle feedlot there, and essentially what the cattle were being fed was kind of corn, which had been heavily sprayed with antibiotics and hormones in order to kind of make them grow fatter quicker. So you've got to think that eating food which has been treated that way is not a great idea. And there is lots of evidence that the overconsumption of antibiotics, and both in the foods we eat, but obviously directly from the pharmacy, has a pretty negative impact on your microbiome. The other thing which does bad things to it is consuming an awful lot of kind of fast foods and things like that, because they have this stuff called emulsifiers in it. Emulsifiers are there to extend the shelf life of it so they can, sell them in petrol stations, gasoline stations, and things like that. But again, that has a really bad impact on the gut bacteria. And the other thing is, overconsumption of sugar. We add sugar to everything. I think American fast foods, it said processed foods, about 80% have added sugar. And again, that's likely to lead to a proliferation of microbes that like that sort of stuff. And that's not going to be good for your gut. So those are my top three villains, if you like, would be too many antibiotics, too much sugar, too much fast food. And
where does stress come in, Michael?
We know these things are bad for you. Sorry?
Where does stress come in as another factor that will alter your healthy gut flora?
Sure. One of the ways, there's a kind of indirect and a direct way. So we know that stress leads to higher production of cortisol, which is a stress hormone, and that in turn can deplete your gut bacteria. The other thing that stress really plays into is it has an effect on your sleep. It means you're likely to have a very poor sleep pattern. And one of the things, again, we know is that if you have even one bad night's sleep, this leads to greater cravings for sugary, carby, junk food. Plus what it does is it kind of sends your blood sugar levels out of control. I did a study recently where we took 20 volunteers who were young and healthy. We deprived them of a couple of nights' sleep, or they had poor sleep for a couple of nights, cut down to 4 hours, and a number of them were bordering on type 2 diabetics by the end of that, and their gut bacteria, we took poo samples as well, and again the diversity had got worse. there were signs of inflammation and things like that. So surprisingly short amount of time of sleep deprivation, and sleep deprivation in turn makes you more stressed. So there's a really hideous, vicious cycle there. The thing I would say is that when I wrote the book, I can touch on the impact of the effect of the different foods have on sleep. But since then, I've done another interesting research project which has looked at the impact of particular types of fiber on your gut bacteria and therefore on your sleep patterns. And that has turned out to be a really exciting area of research. It's something I'm doing with Oxford University. So it turns out there's a particular type of bacteria in your gut which can improve the quality of your sleep. And there are particular types of foods which seem to influence the growth of those. So there's some of that in the book, and there's, you can find out more by going to my website, cleverguts.com. But it kind of it just shows you how quickly this field is moving, because I finished writing the book about 6 months ago, and already there's new stuff coming up all over the place.
Well, that's so interesting. So it's so the sleep, the quality of our sleep will impact the kinds and quality of the microorganisms, the healthy ones, or help to promote the growth of the more unhealthy microbiome that we have. So, I mean, really, when you look at it, just about everything affects what's going on within us, don't you think?
Absolutely. So there is this extraordinary pattern of things which are happening. You know, there's an interaction. So one of the things we know very clearly now is that your biome, your microbiome, has strongly influences your mood. And it does so by all sorts of different ways. So it does this by producing chemicals in your gut, a lot of them things like serotonin, which are the so-called feel-good chemical, which is present in your brain, but even higher quantities are present in your gut. So your gut can send messages to your brain which either make you feel happy or unhappy, and the microbes can subtly influence your food choices as well, which is an emerging area of research. They do so by producing particular chemicals, but also by hacking into the connection between the brain and the gut, which is known, it's called the vagus nerve, and it's a kind of super fast highway. And a bit like kind of Russian hackers kind of breaking into, you know, the Democrats' system database, they can kind of hack into this system and influence what's going on in your brain. And that is really, again, new but fascinating research. So it influences your mood. Strangely enough, it also influences your risk of stroke. A really new piece of research found that, again, the gut biome, if you have an unhealthy gut biome, they produce chemicals which will significantly increase your risk of developing, of having a stroke. So there's a very clear connection, as I said, between what's going on in your brain and what's going on in your gut. And it's not a kind of one-way street. It's not your brain talking to your gut. It's very much the other way. Most of the messages are going the other way. Most of them are going from your gut to your brain and influencing lots of conscious and unconscious feelings you may be having.
You know, when you think about it, it's so profound how everything we're doing is in impacting our microbiome, and how our microbiome has been such a major player in our thoughts and our moods, in risk for things like stroke, the prevalence of allergies, and even our weight issue. This huge epidemic we have of obesity is part of the microbiome story. Do you want to just mention a little bit about how weight is impacted by our microbiome?
Sure, because obviously we're aware that the food we put in our mouth and the drink we consume will impact our weight. And once upon a time, it all seemed incredibly simple. If you want to lose weight, you simply eat less and do more exercise. But it's nothing like as simple as that, because we know, for example, that the amount of calories you actually will absorb from the food varies hugely from person to person. So you actually excrete quite a lot of calories. And unfortunately, people who are overweight, they seem to have a mixture of microbes in their gut, which are much better at absorbing the calories from the food they eat. So they actually could eat exactly the same amount of food as somebody who is slim, and yet they put on more weight simply because they're absorbing more calories from the food. They demonstrated this recently where they did this study in mice, and what they did is they got these mice that are specially kind of bred and brought up so they don't have gut bacteria of their own. And then they fed them gut bacteria from either a fat child or a thin child. And then they allowed the bacteria to kind of colonize the gut. And then they took these mice and they fed them exactly the same amount of calories. And the mice who had been fed kind of feces samples from fat kids, overweight children, they basically became hugely overweight, whereas those who had feces samples from slim children stayed relatively slim, despite eating exactly the same number of calories. So this was pretty compelling evidence. There is actually some research now. People are interested in what's called fecal transplants, where you take samples of feces from healthy volunteers, and you use them to treat certain conditions, and that includes type 2 diabetes and obesity. I'm not saying it's kind of the way to cure obesity, but it certainly shows where this research is going. As I said, there is subtler ways that the microbiome influences your food choices by hacking into your kind of brain and producing cravings, and those cravings may be for sugary, fatty foods, whatever it might be. So the good news is you can alter it. You can kind of, you're not doomed to be the sort of unwitting victims of your microbiome. If you kind of eat the foods that I write about and the, you know, in the book, in the Clever Gut book, then there is good evidence that this will help you kind of lose weight, but also rebalance your gut and reduce your cravings. But it is, you know, it is unbelievably interesting how wide-reaching and far-reaching the microbiome is in its influence on the body, particularly as we knew almost nothing about it, you know, just 10 years ago.
Except in traditional Chinese medicine, in Ayurveda medicine, and other traditional healing arts, they have always known that the health of your intestinal system is critical for your well-being. So, you know, Western medicine's as always,
Western medicine is playing catch up, indeed.
Yeah, it's late to the party.
Still, you know, to be honest, if you have a gut problem, like irritable bowel syndrome or anything like that, it is unlikely you're going to get a great deal of very helpful advice from your physician, because they still rely very heavily, obviously, on drugs, and drugs are not the answer to everything, or indeed many things. I do feel very strongly that there's a lot to be learned from, as you say, other medical or, you know, traditions, but also from the kind of great religions. I'm not personally particularly religious, but fasting is something I do embrace, intermittent fasting, and that's something all the great religions have advocated. And mindfulness is another thing that Buddhists and things like that have embraced down the years, and that in turn seems to be very effective at reducing stress, and therefore a lot of the gut complications we've talked about.
I just a couple of comments. I remember having listening to an interview about the fecal transplants, which are getting a lot more, you know, there's a lot more interest in them, and I guess that whole field is developing. But it was a man in Australia who had very chronic MS, and they did a fecal transplant on him, and it totally cured his MS. I mean, that was a pretty profound interview when he talked about his story. And so You know, we're seeing just how powerful it is when we change our microbiome. But I think the important message, and we're going to get into this the next part of our conversation, is you don't have to have a fecal transplant to change your microbiome.
No, quite. Right?
No, so there are ways.
It is a fairly hardcore way of doing it, yeah.
But it is a popular area, and I know people who are starting to do that, actually, who have weight problems. So there, I think there's someone on the West Coast in San Diego who's doing fecal transplants. It's just it's an emerging field, and I don't know how effective it is, but I know it's gaining a lot of interest right now. It's a real makeover.
Oh, it is a real makeover. There are sort of, you know, banks, whether biobanks or where they store this stuff. There is a particular condition called C. diff, also known as Clostridium difficile. And what happens is that maybe you consume very large amounts, you know, you have a blast of antibiotics, it knocks off your good bacteria, you then get overgrowth in your gut of bad bacteria, and then you're just spending your life on the toilet. It kills 20,000 Americans every year, this particular condition. But it is completely curable by a fecal transplant, 95% success rate. It is the closest I've ever personally seen to a kind of medical miracle, in the sense that I saw somebody go in for it, and beforehand they were on the toilet every, you know, 15 to 20 minutes. They were really ill. They were desperate. They had this, and really within a day they were absolutely fine. So that was just remarkable. So I think it's success of that sort of stuff which has led to its more widespread use. Whether it will prove to be quite as effective in other conditions, I don't know, but certainly for C. diff, it's the most extraordinary thing I've ever seen.
Well, so let's talk about how we can do a makeover and encourage the growth of a healthy microbiome and correct some of the imbalances or maybe some of the insults we have had done to our gut microbiome.
Absolutely. So I think you start with food. And this book is very much about foods that have been shown to absolutely improve your gut biome and give you the best chance of having a kind of healthy gut. Now, in a way, it's in two sections. One is aimed at people whose guts are currently kind of in decent nick but would like to keep them in good condition. And then there are the people who suffer from food allergies or maybe from things like irritable bowel syndrome. And for them, there's a slightly different approach, because if you've got an inflamed bowel already, then foods which are kind of good for healthy bowel are not necessarily good for an inflamed bowel. So I would include amongst those particularly the sort of brassicas, and these are foods like, you know, Brussels sprouts, green leafy vegetables and things like that, which are kind of great for a healthy gut, but would just cause inflammation and gas in somebody who's got a sensitive, inflamed gut already. So you have to kind of distinguish the two. But broadly speaking, the foods that we know are incredibly good for the gut include, obviously, kind of a whole wide range of vegetables, fruits, as many multicolored as possible. The green leafy vegetables seem to be particularly good. And then there are sort of more exotica in the form of the sort of fermented foods. So I've started to embrace them recently, which is kimchi, kombucha, sauerkraut, things which are more familiar to East Europeans or people with, you know, Asians. And that would also include seaweed. And seaweed is spectacularly good for constipation, but again, it also seems to be really good for the gut biome. So there's a kind of range of stuff. I'm pleased to say that smelly French cheeses seem to be good. They contain a lot of kind of good bacteria. Full-fat yogurt, but also kefir, which is kind of fermented yogurt. And a bit of dark chocolate is good, full of flavonoids. Red wine, the occasional glass, seems to be pretty good for your gut bacteria. So it's not all about deprivation. There's kind of a range of different foods that I would urge people to kind of try and explore. And they're really tasty. They just kind of make your taste buds sing as well. So they're kind of good for you, but they're also good for your biome. And the recipes are provided by one of the UK's top nutritionists. So I'm kind of confident in the kind of the quality of the food that you're getting, but also that it is genuinely going to have an impact because it is based on kind of proper science. And this book has been endorsed by Nobel Prize winners and by some of the world's leading gut specialists. So I'm confident that it's the best we know at the present about how to keep your gut in good shape.
You know, I think it just comes back to common sense. You have to give the body real food, and we're understanding that our microbiome needs real food. You need to have the fiber found in vegetables and fruits. You need to have the healthy carbohydrates. You need to, you know, have the kinds of food that a healthy person would be eating, a healthy cell needs, and your healthy microbiome requires. It's the same. It's the same, and it goes back to understanding the importance of eating real food, of really nourishing, of cutting out the fast foods, the fried foods, the sugary foods, because we've been hearing this for so long, but now we're understanding it's affecting the very essence of our beings in these, you know, the microbiome and the world inside our large intestine that influences our immune system, our moods, our ability to lose weight, our ability to sleep, ability to think. It's all there, and we need to just get that message across. How important it is to eat in a way that's feeding our microbiome, which is the same food that's feeding our cells for good health.
Absolutely. And it just kind of gives you another reason why you might want to do this, that you know it's kind of good for your brain, you know it's good for your arteries, but also it's good for your microbiome, and everything is interlinked. So I guess the surprises for me when I was researching the book was just how influential the microbiome is, but also some of these other foods which I was less aware of when I, you know, prior to that. I knew all about the benefits of so-called Mediterranean diet, oily fish, olive oil, and things like that, but I was much less familiar with the benefits to be had from fermented foods. Plus, you know, full-fat yogurt and smelly cheeses. So I was delighted to be able to reintroduce those to my diet, and a bit of dark chocolate, which I do enjoy in the evening.
So a question I always have, when you eat foods that are fermented foods, so we talked about the sauerkraut, the yogurt, the kefir, things like that, my question has always been, does the live microorganisms found in those foods survive and make it through the acidic environment of the stomach? And if so, how do they manage to do that without being destroyed?
Okay. It's a very good question because there are an awful lot of things which are sold to us as kind of, you know, probiotics and marvelous, like some of those sort of yogurty drinks which are sold in supermarkets. And, you know, it's less clear how many of them get through, to be honest. But the advantage of fermented foods is that they are actually cultured in an acidic environment. So if you go to my website, you can actually, cleverguts.com, you can actually watch my wife making some of this stuff. And what you do to make sauerkraut is really simple. You kind of chop up cabbage, maybe a bit of beetroot. You immerse it in a salty brine, so it's completely covered, and you kind of let the microbes get on with it. And the reason you have it in a salty brine, that's just really kind of filtered water with salt in it, is this actually encourages the growth of microbes that like a sort of acidic environment. So the sort of microbes that will grow in sauerkraut or kimchi or things like that are ones that have, you know, they like a salty, vinegary, acidic environment. And they taste quite sort of acidic because they are. And that means that they are robust. They are tough. They're able to take on the acid bath in your stomach. So they are specially cultured, as I said, to survive acid, which means that they're much, much more likely to make their way through to your large intestine. And they also come in very large quantities. So that in a single teaspoon of fermented food, you're getting many billions of different microbes of many different species. And so all of that kind of contributes. We actually did a study in which we got a bunch of volunteers to drink kefir for, I think it was, about 4 weeks. And we were taking their feces samples. And we did see some pretty profound changes in their gut bacteria over that time. So it clearly was getting through. It was making a difference, which was measurable. And so that's kind of why I'm encouraged to write about these things, because otherwise, as you say, there is a danger that you're just kind of eating the stuff and it's all being destroyed. A note of caution is that if you get stuff which is kind of fresh or you make it yourself, then you know that there's living stuff there. We also looked at sauerkraut and some things which came in, you know, in screw-top bottles which have been pasteurized, and we sent those off to be analyzed in a lab, and there was nothing living at all. So there may once have been, you know, something in there which turned the cabbage into sauerkraut, but it had been wiped out by the industrial processes which had led to it, you know, appearing on the supermarket shelf. And to be honest, it also tasted not great. So I'm a great believer in going with taste. My wife, as I said, is a doctor. She's got really into making fermented foods. And there are sort of, you know, some brands. And what I would love is people to kind of come and share their experiences on our website. I'll try and write there about the sort of brands where there is some evidence. And obviously, I'm based in the UK, but if we could create an American community, then it would be very useful so people could kind of share their experiences and what they've learned, because the sort of, you know, the brands of things which I know about in the UK probably don't exist in the US. So, yeah, let's form a digital community where we share best practice and what we've learned.
So that leads me to make people aware of your website, which is cleverguts.com. I did have a look at your site, Michael, and I know you've got a lot of great information, and there is a community. You've always been creating community with all the different topics and books you've written. You always really focus on supporting people and sharing and cross-communication with everyone. So I encourage people to go. Well, first of all, I encourage everyone to get Dr. Michael Mosley's new book, The Clever Gut Diet, How to Revolutionize Your Body from the Inside Out, and then go to his website, which is cleverguts.com, to learn more, to get more recipes. I love the recipes in the book, by the way. I have to say some of them were
Thank
new
you.
And some of them were really inspiring. And I just want to add, when people get fermented foods, go to the refrigerated section, get the sauerkraut out of the refrigerated section, look for the kefir and the yogurts that aren't really commercialized, that are more in your health food store section, that don't have a lot of sugar and artificial flavorings and preservatives in them, because I think that study that you quoted is really interesting. It's like if you get the real deal, it works, but if you get an imitation or a pasteurized process that has destroyed the live microorganisms, you're going to wind up with nothing really beneficial. So it's something
Absolutely.
That people need to be aware of and be selective. And the I love the fact you did that study, and when you had people drinking that kefir, you actually saw the results in their feces when you tested them, that something was really developing and you were creating a healthier environment. I think that's profound, you know, that you were able to document it, so to speak. You know, so we only have a couple of...
That's what I love about science. It is the ability to kind of measure stuff and see stuff. I mean, I would always say that one of the best ways of knowing whether something's working is it working for you? How do you feel? Are you sleeping better? Do you feel better? Are your movements regular? You know, are you managing to keep the weight loss off? I also, you know, because I'm at risk of type 2 diabetes, I regularly check my blood sugar levels just with one of those kind of meters you can buy down in the pharmacy, because that's kind of one of the good measures of how healthy you are. An awful lot of people are pre-diabetic without realizing it. But I think you have to kind of monitor yourself, and that's a good way of detecting whether any of this stuff is making any difference.
Yes, you know, the last question I was going to ask before I know you have to rush off for another interview today is how are you managing your diagnosis of were you actually diagnosed with diabetes or pre-diabetic, and where are you now?
Yep, no, I was diagnosed type 2 diabetic. They ran the tests and they said, look, it's probably relatively recent, but we want to start you on medication. And so I said, no thanks, I'd like to find out something else. And I went off and I made a documentary about it. I lost 20 pounds. I reversed my type 2 diabetes. I put on a little weight since, but, you know, only a pound or two. And my blood sugars have stayed completely normal. And so I actually wrote another book, The 8-Week Blood Sugar Diet, which is all about this. And there's a really big study that's going to come out soon, which is absolutely going to blow people's socks off because, you know, people rely on medication to try and treat their type 2 diabetes or whatever. But actually, medication is not very effective, and diet is a much, much better way of going about it. You can actually, if you like, cure yourself of type 2 diabetes, and a lot of people don't know that. So that's, I think, a really important message which I'd love your listeners to know. But if you're a recent diabetic, if you're a pre-diabetic, you can absolutely do something about it, and it does not depend on medication. But if anything, what medication does is it saps your will to look for alternative routes. Plus, there frankly isn't a great deal of evidence that medications you take have a positive long-term improvement. I've looked at lots and lots of trials, and I have to say one of the things that often happens to people who start on medication for type 2 diabetes is they progress to stronger and stronger medication, because they're not really treating the underlying disorder. All they're doing is they're forcing their liver and their kidneys to pump out more sugar, and they're not really addressing the underlying problem.
Well, that's such a powerful message. I'm so glad we touched on that as we bring our conversation to an end. So thank you, Dr. Michael Mosley. We've been talking to the author of The Clever Gut Diet. Go to his website, cleverguts.com. Great information, great recipe, and be part of the community that's awakening to how we can really transform our health. So, Dr. Michael Mosley, thank you so much for your time and your wonderful work and
pleasure.
The inspiration you always bring. Thank you so much. Talk to you soon.
Thank you very much.
Bye now.
Bye.
And to all my listeners, thank you for joining me today for another opportunity to get empowered with truthful information. And you've been listening to What Women Must Know. I'm Dr. Cheryl Selman. And remember, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.